From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1961 when Audrey Hepburn starred in the film Breakfast at Tiffany's. Hepburn was joined in the cast by Mickey Rooney, who played Mr. Yuniyoshi. Rooney wore makeup and a prosthetic mouthpiece to alter his appearance in order to look like a caricature of a Japanese person. You'd have to imagine that if Hollywood did something so obviously racist today, they'd be called out. But at the time, Breakfast at Tiffany's received many rave reviews, including this from the New York Times, quote, "Mickey Rooney's buck-toothed, myopic Japanese is broadly exotic." Well, thanks to John Oliver's HBO show, we can see a handy list of the many, many times that Hollywood has cast white actors to play non-white roles. Marlon Brando playing Sacchini in The Tea House of the August Moon. Natalie Wood playing Maria in West Side Story. John Wayne as Genghis Khan in The Conqueror. And this habit continues in recent years. Jake Gyllenhaal playing the Prince of Persia. Emma Stone playing the half-Asian Allison Eng in Aloha. Tom Cruise as the Last Samurai. Christian Bale, a British actor, starring as Moses in Exodus, Gods and Kings, set in Egypt. And director Ridley Scott was called out for casting white actors to play Egyptians, including Moses and Ramses. Scott told Variety, quote, "I can't mount a $140 million film and say that my lead actor is Mohammed so-and-so from such-and-such," end quote. And that's the film industry. How about theater? Well, a few weeks ago, we had a conversation about how the local theater scene is growing. But we heard from a number of folks in our community about how that growth isn't always as supportive as it could be of minority actors. And frankly, our own program, our own guest list that hour was really white. This hour, we want to explore how that can change and how we can make sure that we are not overlooking the talent of diversity in our own community. Let me go ahead and welcome our guest for the hour. Mark Davis is here. Mark actually called that program and reached out, and we're glad to have him here. He's a director, a choreographer, a playwright. He's a professor of theater and dance, and he was in the original Broadway production of The Lion King, which goes back how long now, Mark?
19 years in November.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. It's, yeah. Makes us all feel a little aged. I would have said like 10 years. Time flies.
We're about on 20.
Well, you have a long resume as well. Why don't you tell me a little bit briefly about some of the other things that you've done?
Okay, well, I'm a Rochester native. I was born and raised here. I went to East High School, graduated, well, a really long time ago. And I was a competitive figure skater. I received my gold medal in ice dancing in 1979. And I went on to study dance in New York City. And then I moved abroad and I worked and lived in Germany for 11 years. And I became, established myself as a choreographer there, had my own dance theater company. And then I moved back to the States and I got my master's degree in theater and a dance career. And so I put that together into directing and choreographing and teaching theater and performance.
You've got this peripatetic teaching career that's going to take you, what, to California next?
I just was appointed assistant professor of theater and dance at San Francisco State University. I'm actually moving in 10 days from Ohio, where I'm currently living. I just finished a two-year appointment there.
Okay. And you also are involved in a number of projects, and we're going to be talking about what you also want us to know about that's coming up here. In fact, something that's going on right now. We'll get to that in a moment here.
Yes.
I want to welcome our other guest, Randy Barber Kaplan's here, professor of theater and dance at SUNY Geneseo and artistic director of Gensang. And Randy also reached out to me about that particular program. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what Gensang is and what compelled you to reach out on that subject?
Gensang is Geneseo's Asian American Performance Ensemble, and we are now going into our 17th consecutive year, during which time, by the time this year ends, we will have produced 43 plays over 17 years. These are all plays, with one notable exception, William Shakespeare. All of these plays are by Asian American, contemporary Asian American playwrights, and they are cast ethnically specifically with Asian American students. So that's a very, very important aspect of the work that we do. There's no yellow face that is permitted on our campus at large, but specifically Gensang was founded to empower Asian American students to speak in a public space the words that Asian American playwrights specifically wrote for them to speak.
And Edie Toribio Rosenfeld's here, founding member of Latinos de Corazon, which is what, Edie?
Latinos de Corazón is we are a multicultural cultural dance group, and we basically focus in the Latino to preserve the Latino culture, the dance, and to unify the community through dance expression and art. And one of the reasons is because when I first moved to the United States, that's in 1990, I was living in Washington, D.C., and it was a diverse culture there. You know, you have people from all over the world. My friends that I went to college with were from different cultures. So I didn't feel that until I moved to New York State in 94. And when I was there, I was living in a small community only in New York, and we have San Bonaventure University. But every time I saw a Latino, I was very excited because I didn't get to see it. And even for me to buy the foods that I enjoy, you know, from my culture, I have to travel. And so when I moved to Rochester in 2003, I was still segregated, that's the word, from the Hispanics, because I didn't know we had a Hispanic community, and I was living in Webster. So every time I saw a Latino, I was so excited. So I was introduced to Hispanic Heritage Family Day at the Memorial Gallery, which I fell in love with, because they have tables with different countries and stuff. And that's where the idea came to preserve the culture. How do we educate our community so people, Latinos, don't feel different or segregated? And also enriching our community so people know that Latinos have a lot to offer. In a way, also, we have a connection being this community of Rochester, actually a melting pot. So...
Well, good to have you here. Thank you for being here, Edie. I want to start with Randy, because I mentioned in our intro here, you look at the history, especially in American acting. We've had this habit of putting white people in non-white roles. And my first thought when I went back to kind of refresh my memory on Mickey Rooney and Mr. Hunyoshi, and you see that the New York Times was praising that performance, now it looks so... It's hard to even watch, I think. But then I think, well, nothing like that would happen today. But then you look down the list, you know, of it's not quite as a caricature, I guess. But why do we have so many white actors playing Asian roles? Emma Stone, Tom Cruise, Christian Bale. The list goes on here. What do you make of that?
Well, before I answer that question, let me take you pre-Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
Because by the time Mickey Rooney gets up to do Mr. Hunyoshi in Breakfast at Tiffany's, yellowface has been a very long and time-honored practice on the American stage. And it goes back to the 19th century. Indeed, even some African-American performers donned yellowface as a way of identifying Asians as foreign. So we may be people of color, but we're American. You're foreign. And so we can don your face. Mm-hmm. So it's been done for decades and decades. It is a part of the American cinema from the beginning of American cinema. And so really the producers of Breakfast at Tiffany's were just tapping into a long-held practice. And around the same time as Breakfast at Tiffany's comes another film, Rashomon, which no Asian American actor could be in because they were told, we're putting Claire Bloom and Rod Steiger in yellowface, and you're not going to look Asian. Of course, the fact is that any actor in yellowface looks like an alien. They don't look like an Asian at all. That's going backwards from Hunyoshi.
And we're right? Deluding ourselves if we think, well, things are much different today in 2016.
No, they're not at all, unfortunately. And I think when you say, why is this happening, I think you answered your own question when you quoted Ridley Scott.
Money.
Or the perception of money.
Yeah.
And the invisibility of the persistent invisibility of actors and people of color. So Ridley Scott can say, I can't make a gazillion dollars casting Mohammed so-and-so, and not only think that and act on it, but have the unmitigated chutzpah to say it.
To say it with I didn't see much consequence for that.
Right.
You know, again, it had to be John Oliver's show that brought it up in a quote, and I went, this can't be. I mean, this, he couldn't have. He did. He said it. He's just acknowledging the reality.
Well, producers say it all the time. It's that just happens to be a very public, very well-known example. But all of my friends who are in the business and have been in the business for years and years can tell you a story like that where they have been told, oh, can you do kung fu? Can you do it with an accent? Can you be the caricature? Even if you are cast. So that was where Gensang came in.
In the same way, Randy, that we had a conversation recently about Native American mascots on sports teams, and that's the caricature mm-hmm. of our Indian brothers and sisters, that's what Americans sort of know of them instead of something approximating reality, you know, humanity. So you have this issue of white actors playing non-white roles. And then I think a question that I believe Mark raised and others have raised, I don't know if you raised it on the show that day, Mark, though, is you have this question then on why non-white actors and performers aren't getting roles, generally speaking, at all anyway. I mean, it doesn't have to be a non-white actor or performer for a non-white role. It should just be casting talented people. And tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I have to also jump in yeah. and comment on what the whitewashing of characters mm-hmm. of color, and it goes back not just with Asian Americans. I mean, we go back to the minstrelsy of the early 19th century, and the whole concept of blackface, which has continued even into the 50s, featuring stars wearing, and also to mimic and make fun of African Americans. And it was actually a theatrical and entertainment tradition to do so. So it took a long time to even get rid of, just 60 years ago, it was happening. To the point where even in the film Showboat, Lena Horne should have played the role of Julie, but it went to Ava Gardner. And Lena Horne joked about it in her show, The Lady and Her Music, back in the late 70s, about they created a special makeup for Ava Gardner. But getting back to what you were talking about, I think it just depends on the work. It depends on the piece of theater. And also, the argument that Ridley Scott was making is ludicrous. I want to use a really quick example about a production. There's a very successful playwright, Jean Genet, who was a French playwright. He wrote a play in the 1950s called The Blacks. And it was specifically written to address his... he wanted to write about rage. And I recently was in Europe, and I saw a production. I didn't see the production. I wanted to see it because I was really excited to see it, and I had never seen a European production of it. And the director chose, and I know because I lived in Germany for 11 years, I know there's many African Americans and African Germans that speak fluent German and are amazing actors. I've worked with them. And he chose, rather than actually look for African American actors, for a play that's specifically written for a white audience and with black actors. The actors are supposed to be black. The author specified this must happen. The director chose to use a white, predominantly white cast and costume them in, you know, those fabric dolls that they used to have, completely covered and mic'd inside, complete, no eyes, nothing, just like rag dolls. The entire performance, I saw the program, I was so incensed. I wrote the biographer of Jean Genet, Edmund White, and because he knew very specifically that my obsession with Jean Genet's writing and his brilliance was in the fact that he saw socially that kind of thing. So it all depends on how something is written. If you, in America, if you add a black actor into a role that doesn't matter if the character is white or black, if it's not dealing with race, you're already adding a layer of race because that's our society, that's our culture. And that adds a layer of investigation and understanding. So I think that if you take a play, like I'm doing a play right now, and it was always about trying to perform in roles where the character's depth is more important than the color of his skin or her skin. And I think that's when you just toss it off as saying, well, you know, I can't make a $120 million movie, and also I can't find Asian actors that could do it. That's not.
Edie, go ahead.
One of the things that, you know, in my opinion, which is a little bit different of the perspective of other people being born in Latin America and not experiencing the prejudice that people had experienced in the United States. On the other hand, I feel with my dance group or Latinos de Corazón that we train actually our dancers, and you see them perform, and they are some of them. That's why we named the group Latinos de Corazón, because we have a lot of people from, you know, the United States that will perform, and you will not think that they are not of Latin American origins. So I feel that is how we educate our children, you know, breaking that barrier of being prejudiced, and it comes from education. And I know it takes a lot of time, but it's understanding the other cultures.
Well, on that note then, let me ask our panel then, if you look at, broadly speaking, popular shows that are on stage now, again, Mark was in The Lion King's original production, but take just about anything that we typically see. I think, Randy, you mentioned an email. What about Death of a Salesman? What if we were casting now? Why can't casting be more multicultural? Do we see that happening anywhere? Is that something that should happen? Randy, what do you think?
Well, why doesn't it? I don't want to speak about any specific production in the area. I'm not privy to what the casting directors are thinking at, say, for example, Jiva. But there's, in my mind, there is no reason why everybody since you brought up Death of a Salesman, there's no reason in my mind why the entire family has to be white. Our everyday experience shows us that American families are not always two white parents and 3.2 white kids. So, I mean, this is our reality as a nation anyway. There's no reason that it shouldn't happen. Now, if the play revolves around race specifically, and Mark and I were talking about this before the show started, Raisin in the Sun, for example, it is ludicrous to cast that show as anything but an African-American family. That said, you know, there are all kinds of strange permutations that we are seeing directors go through right now. You would be familiar with this living in Ohio, Mark.
The Kent State production of Mountaintop by Katori Hall.
Thank you.
What's the story there?
Actually, I was literally just thinking of that. The Mountaintop is a play written by Katori Hall. It's two actors. It's the story of Martin Luther King at the Lorraine Motel the night before he was assassinated. And it deals with him and what he was going through emotionally, and a maid that comes in and out of the story and his conversation with this maid. And without the knowledge of the playwright, at Kent State, an African-American director decided to double cast the role of Martin Luther King with a black actor and a white actor. And the playwright was incensed, and there was a huge public outcry. I mean, I forgot how, you know, it's just, this was like maybe a half a year ago a year ago.
Yeah.
But what was the reason? Why would they do that?
You know, what happened, this is actually very interesting, is because I met Katori Hall when I lived in Memphis a couple of years ago at a production of Mountaintop. And because she would never think that anybody would ever cast a white man in the role of Martin Luther King, because it's just what Dr. Cabell was just saying, is that it must be, it's just that specific.
It's just common sense.
And for some reason, the director, who was African-American and a professor or a guest director or something at Kent State, said he wanted to see what the impact would be of a white man speaking the words of of Martin Luther King. And the playwright since then, and her argument was, and she wrote the play, she found out through a, she was in London at the time working, and she found out through a friend over the internet that this had happened, and she contacted the director and was like, why are you doing that? He was unrelenting. He would not have a conversation with her about it. Or at least the conversation didn't go where it would have been benefited her because it's her play. And she ended up making a clause with her agent and with the Dramatists Guild that there's now a clause in her play, like with this play, The Blacks, I was talking about, where an African-American actor must play that role. But having said that, she just would assume that, she made an assumption that people would get that. And any kind of like trying to put the words of a great man in her play, those weren't Martin Luther King's words. That was a character that she created based on her personal experience coming from Memphis. And so she was trying to determine through this director, why would you want to do that? What, it doesn't take the story any further. It doesn't develop the environment and the agency of the characters by putting the words into a white actor's mouth. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't trying to whitewash the character. It was an experiment that he just should not have happened.
Well, corollary to that, I think is something we should take this opportunity to point out to our listeners, is that very many people believe that if you pay royalties, you bought the play.
Right.
And it doesn't matter, even if we're talking about ethnically specific plays, you didn't buy the play.
Right.
So you don't get to do with the play as you will, just
right.
because you've paid royalties for the production.
Right.
Parallel to that was an instance at Clarion University where a Caucasian director took a play by Lloyd Sue, an Asian American playwright, Jesus in India, which takes place in India. It seems self-explanatory, the casting, and not only cast it with Caucasian students, but turned it into a musical without the playwright knowing. We need to take this opportunity to make this very clear. It doesn't matter what play you're doing.
Right.
You didn't buy the play.
Right.
Okay. And let me also just say, we've had some listeners point out they didn't like the Tom Cruise Last Samurai reference. They think that was, I may have gotten something wrong about that film, which I did not see. And if I was wrong about that bit of appropriation, I apologize. So if you're calling to be and you're upset about me missing that one, I'll own it. But I think there's a lot of other examples we could have used, and I did use. Anyway, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the stage. We're talking about performance in its many forms. And we're talking about whitewashing. We're talking about diversity on stage and how we can be, I think, a little bit more egalitarian on stage, how we can be a little bit more welcoming of diversity on stage, and why it is, or at least let me ask our panel if you agree with this, why it is that typically when a white actor plays a non-white role, there's very little outcry. We see that in Hollywood. We see that on stage. But if Willie Loman and his family in Death of a Salesman were, you know, Latino or a black family or an Asian family, and that was just how the production was presented, I feel like there would at least be a headline or people complaining a little bit.
Let me give a little shout out to my colleague at UC Berkeley, Philip Kangatanda, who is a sansei, a third-generation Japanese-American playwright. And his play, The Wash, is very specific to a Japanese-American family. The parents, the elderly parents, are going through a divorce, and they've been interned. They've come out of the camps. Philip is currently working on a project called the WASH Project with families of Latino and African-American and Middle Eastern, and I want to say Jamaican or Haitian, I can't remember, Caribbean, American origin, to create the WASH. When you see the WASH, everybody who sees it just falls apart because it's a family and you understand it. But that's not to erase the differences. what Phil is doing is creating new versions of this play that speak to ethnically specific populations that are not, in fact, Asian American. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you also have to walk that line of not only whitewashing, but going down that road of, you know, oh, I don't see difference. There is difference, and we need to celebrate and honor that difference and not erase that difference.
Sure, but there's no post-racial America.
No, please. Sorry.
But I think more where I was going, Dr. Kaplan, was this notion of if we start diversifying casts for roles that were not specifically written for race, that necessarily wouldn't be a negative thing, though I think there would be a little bit of a backlash.
Just do it.
I agree. I think, you know, Julie Taymor, the director of The Lion King, said something once about the masks being on the heads of the actors. And she was I'm paraphrasing it, but I remember her saying, she goes, I think people are smart enough to discern, because people were concerned about, you know, like, well, how will they know, where will they know where to look? Where will, you know, if they, will they be looking at the mask? What if they... And she was like, I think people can discern, you know, where I, as a director, I'm directing their eye and what I, you know, what the compelling dynamic is of what I'm trying to say. And I think that, I think audiences and I think people are innately intelligent enough to discern how truthful a human story is. Willie Loman is a character imbued with complex desires and impulses, as is his entire family, and that's what the play is about. And it's not about race. So that particular play and hundreds of thousands of other plays could be cast in that way, and it would just take a really smart director to discern how this story is compelling, how any story, any play is compelling to an audience. And I just want to use a really quick example. A colleague of mine, his name is Timothy Douglas. He's an African-American director, a very excellent African-American director. And there was a play recently called Mothers and Sons by Terrence McNally, which is about a gay couple. This woman's son has died of AIDS. His former partner is married. This is a contemporary play. It was written in 2013 or 2014. And originally, it was played by Tyne Daly on Broadway. And Timothy, who was black and gay, decided, he discussed this with Terrence McNally even, and Cincinnati Playhouse, and decided to, he wanted to have an African-American woman play the mother. This is sort of a wealthy Dallas housewife, mother, mm-hmm. woman. And she comes to New York for a surprise visit, and she also made the partner, the former partner, African-American. So the character that's not present is this deceased young man that died of AIDS 20 years prior to the story taking place. And by adding an African-American, two main African-American characters, the partner of the African-American man was white, and they had a white son. So already, just by changing the racial dynamics of this American play, it added race without adding race. Do you see what I'm saying? It just creates another layer of tension and conflict, possible conflict between a black woman and her son's ex-lover. She never, you know, it just added a layer of depth to it. And that's what can happen with a non-traditionally cast production if the director knows what he wants to do and is adding that opportunity for people to have a conversation in the theater.
All right, I'm late for our only break of the hour.
Oh, sorry.
And we're going to come. It's not your fault. It's nobody's fault. I'm enjoying the conversation with our guest. That's Mark Davis, a director, choreographer, playwright, professor of theater and dance. Dr. Randy Barber Kaplan's here, professor of theater and dance at SUNY Geneseo and the artistic director of Genseng. Edie Toribio Rosenfeld, the founding member of Latinos de Corazon. And after this short break, we're going to check in with Stephen Pasquarella, who's the president of Artists Unlimited, as we talk about the stage in our community and diversity on stage on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, Karen DeWitt joins us from Cleveland, the Republican National Convention. We'll have reports from Karen throughout the week, and we will have a conversation on the Republican Party
Donald Trump's selection of Governor Mike Pence of Indiana as his running mate, and more. It kicks off a week of political conversations on Connections. Talk with you Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I want to welcome to the program Stephen Pasquarella, who's the president of Artists Unlimited, on the line with us now. Stephen, welcome. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Tell us what Artists Unlimited is, first of all.
Well, Artists Unlimited is a program that provides opportunities for individuals with physical and or developmental disabilities, the opportunity to participate in performing arts, mainly musical theater, and we also have a choral program that we do each year.
And Stephen, where do you, where do we find performances? You know, where does it happen?
Mainly at Kodak Center for Performing Arts for the last 4 or 5 years. Prior to that, we had been doing it with a smaller cast at the old German House in Rochester.
And Stephen, we've been talking about what diversity on stage means and why sort of casting and the performances often go to sort of white, privileged, able-bodied people. Some of it, I guess what I want to ask you is, do we need to do better? Do we need to do a better job of what inclusion on stage means for everyone?
Well, I guess I can't speak for all theater programs, but the Artists Unlimited was brought about because there was an individual who saw someone who basically had who had talent and was asked why aren't you on that stage? And the mother of that individual had said, well, nobody wants my child because he was disabled in either developmentally or physically. And so that brought about this program. After a little bit of research, that brought about the program because essentially there were no programs for mainly individuals with disabilities. So can we do better, as per your question? I would say sure. I wish there were more programs like ours out there so that there are more individuals could become involved in this, in a program like ours, because, you know, we have limited resources, we have limited space, and we have limited volunteers. I mean, the whole program is volunteer driven, which is one of the reasons why it's successful. However, to answer your question, yeah, sure. I think we certainly could do better to have more programs like this.
I'm going to be asking our guests to tell us a little bit more about what they and their organizations are doing, particularly this summer. So, Stephen, before I let you go, why don't you let our audience know how to check out more of the work and what's going on now?
Okay, we're going to be doing Beauty and the Beast this November, first two weekends in November, at the Kodak Center for Performing Arts. And that's really the next time that persons could, you know, check out the final production. However, honestly, we could use volunteers. We build our own sets. We do everything that you would normally do in any program. However, if anybody's interested in volunteering, they can check out our website, which is rocartistsunlimited.com.
Thanks for taking the time to join this discussion on diversity on stage and what it means in all of its facets, Stephen. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Stephen Pasquarella, the president of Artists Unlimited. Now, let me go ahead and grab a phone call because we've got some listeners who want to jump into this conversation. And Tom in Greece.
Hello.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yes. You've been talking about diversity in the theater and everything. I think Hamilton on Broadway is a major step forward. And it's sort of the reverse of this whole topic of discrimination against people of color in the theater, in that it was casting a man of a Latino Hispanic man in the role of a famous white man. You know, we have this image from paintings and pictures of everything, of Hamilton and everything, as just a white man. And when I found out that a Hispanic man was playing him, I thought, well, how could that happen? But then it links the energy of hip hop with the energy and drive in Hamilton's life. And so now I remember that should be like a major change in the theater, because the replacement for Lin-Manuel Miranda is also Hispanic. And I think that, okay, I remember way back, I guess it was in the late 80s, maybe 1988 or something, there was a show on Broadway, I saw a Miss Saigon, in which the main character was a man who was Vietnamese. He was like a hustler, always trying to make money and everything out in the streets of Saigon, but it was a white actor whose name I can't remember.
Jonathan Price.
They gave him Asian makeup, and that was a controversy at the time, you know, that they didn't hire an Asian actor to take that place, and they gave him the slanted eyes and everything, you know, like this was the 1980s, and it's sort of going back to the Charlie Chan era and everything. I just wanted to think of what you would say about that. Okay, I'll take my answer off the air.
Tom, thanks for the phone call. I'll go around the table. Mark, you want to start there?
Yeah,
go ahead.
First, about the Miss Saigon issue, which still goes on in New York City, as a member, as a Broadway actor, and I remember that well. Jonathan Price was the name of the actor. He did the role in London. When they wanted to transfer Miss Saigon to Broadway, there was a huge uproar by Asian actors, and it's still a landmark incident. It's an ongoing policy in regards to how people address that. In regards to Hamilton, yes, Hamilton isn't the beginning or end of that, but Lin-Manuel Miranda found in his ability to have agency as an artist, he found an environment where his voice could progress and be received, very well received. His collaboration on Hamilton is profound, but his love and interest of his history, he found aligned and coalesced around Alexander Hamilton's. And so that, as it's going to be a groundbreaking and will always be a groundbreaking landmark musical, like A Chorus Line, like Lion King, like Showboat, all of these shows have as a performance, it's a reflection of truth about that community. And I think Hamilton is, yes, it's great, but it's not the be-all, end-all. It's many, many things, and it opened up a door. But is that door going to remain open for productions like that? Or is it just everybody wants Hamilton now, and is that it? Or are people going to continue to promote communities like Rochester and smaller mid-sized American cities where there's lots of hip-hop artists that will never see the light of a stage or be asked to contribute to something?
Okay. Randy, what do you think?
Well, here's when we're going to know that we've been successful. I agree with Mark that Hamilton is a point on a spectrum. And it's always worrisome to me when there's a show like this and someone says, well, but we have Hamilton. So the inference being that we're getting better.
It's like we have a black president.
Hamilton is like our black friend.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like a white person, but I've got a black friend.
Right.
You're like, saying
and
Hamilton
we have a black president,
be,
right.
Hamilton could
exactly.
become our
black president. So I'll tell you when we're, and I don't know if we'll ever recover from the Miss Saigon controversy, because there are a whole lot of issues attendant upon that besides Jonathan Price, as in, could we have some roles for Asian women and Asian American women that are not
prostitutes.
The prostitutes or the, you know, the whore who kills herself. I believe Elizabeth Wong, the playwright in her play China Doll about Anna May Wong, talks about, I've killed myself a million times from the perspective of an Asian American female performer. And I'll tell you when we're going to know when we're going to be successful is when we don't need shows like this anymore.
Right.
Well, first of all, Edie, you want to weigh in on Hamilton, and then I want to read a follow-up email on this subject. But Edie, go ahead.
Uh-oh.
Oh, okay. In my opinion, with race in performance, I think as we continue to grow and I believe by 2050, we say that probably 50% of the the United States is going to be a Latino descendant. So we'll start seeing the changes. And I still believe that with education, we could change the mentality of people. And for us to understand that we're unique and that we love ourselves the way we look. And so teaching my children in educating the community at the same time, you know, about race, not hating because you look different, but taking advantage of what that person can offer to you.
Well, got an email from a listener named Dan, who basically says, give me a break. Hamilton has African-American and Latinos in the cast playing historically white people. If the problem that you and the panel is describing was real, that wouldn't have happened. Dan is saying Hamilton is proof that this is not even an issue.
Oh, please, may I?
Go ahead, Mark.
I'll assume that Dan is white.
I don't know.
I'm just gonna make a shot in the dark, and I'll just assume, because I don't think an African American or Latino person would even say that there's no problem, because as soon as you say there's no problem, that obviously showcases to me that there is. I think one of the most important things about having the opportunity that Lin-Manuel Miranda took upon himself to interpret the history of the country of his origins, which is America, is paramount to sharing culture. He is of Latino descent. I think he's Puerto Rican, I believe. He's Puerto Rican, born and raised in New York City. And if you've seen the musical In the Heights, which is the precursor to Hamilton, his first show, it won the Tony Award in 2008, I believe, for Best Musical. It is ingenious, because it incorporates the dynamism and energy of that. He took his opportunity to express his culture. Now, would Hamilton be the same thing if it was, I'm sorry, I want to add something. I just found this out. The Encore series in New York City at City Center is doing a production of 1776 with a multiracial cast. So you're taking the same period of time as Hamilton. Because Hamilton is such a huge success, they're taking a musical that was originally done with all white casts and taking characters like Abigail Adams, and it's going to be a biracial woman playing Abigail Adams. And because of the success of Hamilton, it reopens the door of dialogue. If everything was just peachy keen and we were all just so accepting of everything, Hamilton wouldn't be as powerful as it was. It's taking a dynamic of culture and looking at something through another lens, not the lens, but another lens. And it's just popular because it's really truthful and powerful.
You see why we've got professors on the program? I want to take your class, Mark. Let me grab a few other phone calls here. We're going to try to move quickly because we're going to start running out of time. Our friend Adele Fico's on the line. Hi, Adele. Go ahead. Hi, Adele.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, it's Adele Fico from School of the Arts. How are you?
Good.
I'm at home making dinner for a dinner party tonight, and I was loving the conversation. I just called to say that one of the things that we've done at School of the Arts since its inception is we are colorblind when it comes to casting, so that we can work with our students to teach them that it's the ability that gets the role, not the color of the skin that gets the role. So we, you know, this past spring we had a Hispanic Mary Poppins and an African-American Bert, and we've had a African-American Beast in Beauty and the Beast, and African-American John Proctor in The Crucible. And one of the wonderful things, from my perspective, is that you'll see somebody who might not even consider going out for a role unabashedly going out for that role, because they know that they can nail it despite what the color of their skin might be, or their ethnicity, or their heritage might be. So it's a little promotion, promotion for School of the Arts and what we're teaching our kids, but we think that it's one of the most important things that we can teach our kids, especially if they're considering having a career and going on. We want them to have the confidence to be able to audition for whatever they want to audition for.
Thank you, Adele. Thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
And Edie, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
I want to say that, you know, in her comment, that high schools are actually are doing a wonderful job with children in not seeing color. 2015, one of my children, Brandon, he was in a play in Thomas High School, Sweet Charity, that's the name of the play. The main character, Sweet Charity, the girl, is African-American, and my son actually played Charlie in the, and he's of Latino descendant. So it was a combination of, you know, ethnicities, but no race was mentioning. So, you know, colorblind, so that's good.
All right, try to keep moving as quickly as we can. Samantha in Dansville, next up. Go ahead, Samantha.
Hi there. I'm going to pose a question. I want you to take my comments off the air.
Okay.
I've recently seen some productions in some high school in rural New York area, and they did The Wiz, and they did The Lion King, and it was an all-white cast because there really aren't very many kids of color in that area. And I'm just wondering what the panelists feeling about doing shows that are so traditionally black or, you know, cast in that way. That, you know, how it kind of feels weird to do it one way, but it feels really weird doing it the other way. So I just felt the whole experience was really uncomfortable for me, like having known both productions, the way they're meant to be done. And I just was wondering how you guys feel about that. And I'll take those comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Samantha.
I have to jump in on this one. I just had this conversation with Tom Schumacher, who's the president of Disney Theatrical, last year. He told me that Lion King was going to be, licensing, there's junior versions of many Broadway shows that schools can do.
Yep.
I feel very strongly that educationally, I think it's very important to teach kids that they can do whatever they want to, including a white kid being Mufasa or being Simba. I think that's fine. I think when it starts getting to a place where professionally and financially, when theaters are producing work to sell tickets, the kind of work that's being produced, that is should be really addressed, because it becomes with a whole bunch of other issues in regards to financing, ticket sales, especially with regional theaters, subscriber series, what kind of shows are they presenting, why are they presenting these shows, what audiences are they really catering to. But in schools, I think that's amazing. I think it should be that way. It should be that way everywhere at any time. It just always needs to make the, you always, people need to make the effort to understand what is the cultural product, what do we want to say, what do we want to teach our kids.
Well, it's really important also, I think, for the directors of such productions to wade very carefully through the waters of cultural appropriation.
Right.
Well said. I'm going to sneak in one more quick phone call, and then I want our guests to tell us what they're working on. But so we got to keep it tight. This is Hannah, who's originally from New York City, and now where, Hannah? Hi there, Hannah. Can you go ahead?
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead, Hannah.
Hi. My name is Hannah. I am originally from New York. I'm a Jen Singer alumni. I was a former student of Randy Kaplan, who's on your show.
Hello!
I'm currently in the Army, and I'm stationed in Germany, so I'm calling from Germany.
Oh, okay. Yay. Well, Hannah, it is great to have you. I'm not going to try to cut you off, but we are a little short on time. So in 30 seconds, say whatever you want to say, and it's great to have you. Go ahead.
Great. I just want to say that, all the teachers and professors who really kind of promote the arts without seeing race or color as role defining, and kind of opening our eyes to what we're capable of as young adults really shapes us in what we see as possible in our adult lives. So I just want to thank all the educators out there, and Randy, thank you especially for me.
Thank you, Hannah.
Hannah, thank you for calling from Germany. Thank you so much. I think Randy almost had tears in her eyes. So I know she's happy to hear your voice, and I'll let Randy just real briefly, you want to respond to Hannah there? Go ahead.
Well, hi, Hannah. I just want to say that Hannah really gets it. She has choreographed for me. She's musical directed for me. She's acted for me. And I was just rereading some of your own words this morning, Hannah, about your realization that by doing Gensang, that you were able to be a leader and that you were able to share your culture with people outside your community. I remember you writing to me and saying, my family drove all this way from New York, and they couldn't believe that anybody outside the Korean-American community was interested in Korean court dance.
Well, Randy, we've got about 90 seconds, so why don't you tell us what Gensing is. Can people check it out now? What's going on?
Well, the best way for people to get in touch about Gensing, we don't have a website, but you can write directly to me at kaplanr@geneseo.edu. And we have a Facebook page, Gensing, G-E-N-S-E-N-G, Gensing Geneseo. And you can go to that page and see photographs of all of our productions.
All right, Mark Davis, what's going on right now?
I am co-producing with my colleague Jerry Argetzinger, a 40-year veteran professor of cultural studies at RIT, NTID. We have a production of the play Art by Yasmina Reza, a French woman of color playwright. And we opened on Wednesday. We have a performance tonight at 8 p.m., tomorrow at 8 p.m. as well. And it's at Muck on 142 Atlantic Avenue.
You know where Starry Nights is. So Atlantic is right near University and Atlantic. And it is a beautiful, lovely, intimate place
to see. It's a wonderful place. We've got an awesome set designed by a colleague at LSU, an African-American scenic designer. It's brilliant. The show's great. It's hysterical and moving. And don't miss it. You have to come see it.
8 o'clock tonight.
8 o'clock tonight, 8 o'clock tomorrow night.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And where can they find more online, Edie, about Latinos de Corazón?
Yes, we have a website, latinosdecorazon.org. So you could go on Google, find it. We also have Facebook, Latinos de Corazón, and you could find more information, and you could inbox me there too.
Thank you all for educating us about what's going on and pushing the conversation forward. Thank you for being here. Mark.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Andrus, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Evan. We'll talk with you Monday.